Before we start into our lesson this morning on Hannah, I wanted to revisit what we talked about right at the end of class last week about Moses and his punishment and what happened. We talked about that God told Moses to strike the rock. If we go back and read Numbers chapter 20 in verse 8, the first time in Exodus 17, God did tell him to strike the rock. But unless I've missed it in Deuteronomy somewhere, and that doesn't mean I didn't, but I've looked and looked and re-looked. Let me get in the right book, and that might help me. In Numbers chapter 20 in verse 8, it says, the people are complaining, they don't have water, they've just buried Miriam, and they're contending with Moses again. Only if we'd have just perished when our brothers perished before the Lord. And I'm assuming he's talking about in the after the people died when they wouldn't go into the land. But in verse 8, God tells Moses, take the rod, and you and your brother Aaron assemble the congregation and speak to the rock before their eyes that it may yield its water. You shall thus bring forth water for them out of the rock and let the congregation and their beasts drink. Moses took the rod from before the Lord just as he had commanded him. And then they go on to tell them, you rebels, shall we bring forth water? And then he strikes the rock twice. So in this instance, I could find nowhere that God told him to do anything but to speak to the rock. And so we talked about why, and we don't know why Moses didn't get to go in. It's never explicitly lined out. Verse 12 of that chapter, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you have not believed me to treat me as holy in sight of the sons of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them. So it was because of this incident, and whatever it was, evidently, Moses' faith was not what it should have been, because he said, you did not believe me or treat me as holy. So, and then over in Psalms 106, verse 33, the psalmist writes, and he's talking about all that they've done in Israel and all their... talks about in verse 6 through 12 there, that at the crossing of the Red Sea, and then 13 through 15, they wanted meat, and then it's Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, and the golden calf, and the rebellion after the spies at Sinai sent into the land, and so on and so forth. And it gets down to verse 32. They also provoked him to wrath at the waters of Meribah, so that it went hard with Moses on their account. Because they were rebellious against his spirit, he spoke rashly with his lips. If you'll notice, if you have a footnote in the text, both the his and spirit are capitalized. But in the margin, it says or. As David mentioned in the meeting, when you see capitals, it's up to the translators as to what they put. So I don't know if they were rebellious against Moses. They were rebellious against God, but Moses bore the brunt of all their, he was the face, and he got there, and maybe it was just, he had had enough, and so, but whatever it was, he spoke rashly with his lips. So I don't know why, we just know that it was something, it is something he said with his lips. But we don't know if God also held him accountable for striking the rock rather than just speaking to it. But whatever the problem was, Aaron and Moses both died. Aaron died, according to Numbers 33:38, in the 40th year from the time they left. So this was right at the end of the 40-year wandering that Aaron died and Eleazar became priest. And then as they were getting ready to go cross over, God would not allow him to cross over the Jordan and go into the promised land on that side. So is there any question? I just wanted to go back and revisit that because I felt like I did not handle that. And I appreciated one more thing I wanted to mention that Linda brought up. Let's look at Deuteronomy chapter 3. You know, how many times did Moses contend with God, argue with God, however you want to put it, and God relented? He listened to Moses almost every time, other than this time. But look down in verse 23.
What chapter?
Deuteronomy chapter 3. Moses, he's telling them not to be afraid, that they're going to be able to take the land beyond the Jordan, that they're going to possess it. In verse 23, he said, "I also pleaded with the Lord at that time, saying," and he goes on to plead with the Lord, "You've just now begun to open up to me, and I've seen your greatness and your strong hand." And then verse 25, "Let me, I pray, cross over and see the fair land that is beyond the Jordan, that good hill country in Lebanon. But the Lord was angry with me on your account and would not listen to me. And the Lord said to me, 'Enough, speak to me no more of this matter.'" He tells him to go up to Pisgah and he'll be able to look over, but that's all he's going to be able to do. And so here Moses has had a lot of, I don't know, influence. I don't know what you say, but he's had a lot of sway on God, changing God's mind. But it was always for the good of God that God did that. Moses, and nobody that I know of would have ever felt hard at God if he would have listened to Moses this time also. But he didn't. He said, "No, it's enough. I don't want to hear about it anymore." And so Moses, as far as we know, that's what he did. He got busy. He did what he was supposed to do. And so what we can take away from that is sometimes we may plead for God for something. We've done something and we're getting consequences, and we may plead for the consequences to end, but they may not. Sometimes our consequences are set, and Moses' consequences were set, and there was nothing that he could say to God that would change God's mind. Okay, is there any other questions or any comments that anyone has on that? That may have been totally not necessary, but in my mind I needed to be sure that I had left the right impression.
I'm convinced that this incident did not cause Moses to lose his soul.
Oh no, God never said that. We suffer a lot of consequences, just like David. David suffered consequences, but I have every confidence. And when we look at David, we'll see how severe his consequences were. But I have every confidence that he was still a man after God's own heart, but he made a bad mistake.
After all, Jesus said, "You have Moses and the prophets."
That's exactly right. So I don't think he would have used Moses as an example. Had that not been true.
The Hebrew writer and also one of the psalmists says that the devil struggled with Michael for the soul of Moses.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and he didn't win.
No. And so that can give us courage that no matter how hard our life gets, God's there to help us. He's not. It's very comforting to me when he writes, "God will not allow you to be tempted above what you are able to bear." And that's the case with every man that God has ever created. When we choose to sin and leave God, it's because that's the choice we make. Okay, let's turn to 1 Samuel. I chose Hannah because she was a woman. And I thought we can see that sometimes there's women that are, and there's plenty more throughout the scriptures, women of faith that we could have looked at. That Hannah was one that she showed her imperfection early on. What do we see in Hannah that shows her imperfection? Did she handle her? Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Oh, well, I just put that. A wife is supposed to. Is to help me of the husband, and whether you have children or not, he should be the most important. And mm-hmm. He was not feeling the most important.
That's exactly right. She was not handling her disappointment in having children.
Yeah,
And was that Elkanah's fault? It wasn't that he couldn't have children. She was the one who had the problem, evidently, because he was able to have children with his other wife. And so, chapter 1, verse 8, Carol, would you read 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 8, please? This is what Elizabeth pointed to. He was feeling the pain of what she was doing, but there was nothing he could do about it. And if this continues on in a marriage, have you ever known people that the wife is just not happy, and no matter what the husband does, good men, they just cannot seem to make her happy. What, there's always, the goalpost keeps being moved. And is God pleased with that? No, we as wives, and just as Christians, period, need to learn to be content with what we have and what God has blessed us with. You know, how many times have you looked around and thought somebody had a blessing that you thought was a great blessing, but then you look around and you have a blessing greater than what they have? And so, and if nothing else, we can see that our faith should be a great blessing to us, and that should guide our lives. But Hannah is not, she has faith, but she's not allowing her faith to guide her steps at this point. You know, she wants something so badly that she can't seem to not do without it. She cannot be happy without it.
She wouldn't eat. So it makes people sick. Don't you know people who are so depressed and so sad and so distraught that they're unfruitful in anything? They don't accomplish anything, you know, during mm-hmm. the day, good or bad. They're just stuck in place, you know. And we can allow disappointments to do that if we're not careful.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if, from reading this, I don't know if this was always her demeanor, because in verse 7 it says this happened year after year, as often as she went up, her rival would bitterly irritate her, and she would weep, and she wept and would not eat. So I don't know if this was her that every single day thing, or if it was just exacerbated by the going and here this woman, you know, they're offering the sacrifices, and what she wanted so deeply, she did not feel that she had anything. Maybe she felt she didn't have anything to offer. I don't know, but I may be wrong. But from what I read, it's simply this time of the year. You know, you ever know somebody that a certain time of the year just kind of overwhelms them in their depression, or sometimes they're not really depressed, but their sadness and their mourning just kind of overtakes them. I know some people, it's the time of their mate's death is a very sad time, which is understandable, but they don't let it get them to where they can't do anything and won't even eat. I guess there are probably people who are. But anyway, that's what I see is her case here. And that should not have been the case. It still was causing a problem with her husband. How could he go worship and offer his sacrifices if all she's doing is crying and carrying on and not eating, and he's worried about her instead of focusing on what he came to do, offer the sacrifices to God?
And she was the favored wife. Mm-hmm. She gave her a double portion.
Mm-hmm.
She's not looking for her blessings at this time.
No, she's not. Her blessings are the farthest thing from her mind. It's what she wants. Do we ever get that way? We want something and we think we really, you know, whatever it is, whether it's a new dress or a new house or take a trip, you know, the trip you've planned all your life and thought, oh, if I don't get to do this before I die, my life won't be complete. I hear people talk like that. You know, I'm going to get there before I die. If I don't, I'll just be sad. Well, anyway. But What does she do that still shows the great faith that she had?
She prayed to God and left it in His hands.
Right. Let's look at chapter 1, verse 24 through 28. Of course, first of all, she's prayed, and Eli told her, "Go in peace, God will grant your petition." And so she had faith. She believed Him. She got up. She worshiped before the Lord and returned to her house. And then she conceived and she gave birth to Samuel. And it's time for the sacrifices. And what does she tell Samuel? Did she go up with Samuel for the sacrifice? No.
Her husband?
Yeah, her husband, Elkanah. What did I say, Samuel? All right, sorry about that. Elkanah. No, she didn't. She waited until she weaned him. What did she promise God if He would give her a child?
She would give him back to God.
I have often wondered, how old is Samuel when he's taken to the temple? He's weaned. She kept him until she weaned him. So,
I read that in that time, 3 years old was when they usually weaned.
Well, and it was interesting because she brought a three-year-old, was it lamb? Three-year-old bull. She took a three-year-old bull. So, I don't know. But if he was three, can you imagine now you go and you leave this baby that you have prayed so hard for? How easy would it have been to say, well, I need to keep him until he's 10. He needs a mama until he's at least 10. And then can you imagine by the time he's 10, it would be real easy to say, well, you know, if I take him and leave him in the temple, he's not going to have a mother or a father. He needs his father to teach him all these other things, teach him about God. But she didn't. She took him however old he was. And evidently he was pretty young because it says in verse 24, the child was young. Of course, young is relative. But she takes him and she leaves him. What great faith.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She said.
Yeah, he could. He could. Because under the old law, if a woman made a vow, her husband could null and make that null and void when he heard about it, and then she would not be held responsible. But he didn't either. So we see his faith also. And then in her prayer, especially the first three verses, Susan Dunbar, would you read 1 through 3 of chapter 2 of 1 Samuel?
And Hannah prayed and said, "My heart rejoices in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. I smile at my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. No one is holy like the Lord, for there is none beside you. Now is there any rock like our God? Talk no more so very proudly. Let no arrogance come from your mouth. For the Lord is the God of knowledge, and by Him actions are weighed."
Who do you think she's thinking about when she talks about her enemies? The other wife. That's, you know, God gave me this, but in her great faith, she gives him back to God and takes him to the temple. And I'll just be honest, I cannot fathom, I don't care how old my child is, telling him, this is what I promised and this is what I'm going to do. Especially if he's, say, less than five. How do you explain to a child, mama's going to leave you and you'll be okay, and you walk away? But that's what she did. So she was, even in her imperfectness, she had faith. She, when Elkanah told her what he was going to do, I mean, not Elkanah, Eli told her what God would do, she gets up, she goes home, and she becomes pregnant. She has this child, she weans him, and she takes him back to God. And
I found two other things, if I may. It sort of struck me, because sometimes when we're in the same kind of situations or like this, that we may be distraught or things are happening in our lives, when she was praying there and Eli accused her falsely of being drunk, I see a faith in it, and of how her demeanor and how she speaks back to Eli, and the respect that she had for God's anointed high priest, even though she was being falsely accused. And sometimes it takes great faith and control, and you know, to not lash back out, you know, and the way that she speaks to him. And then when she did have Samuel, she named him from the Lord. And it just showed that her faith in the Lord, it just helped her to go on, and I'll keep my vow. And she did what she did.
She did. And how did God continue to bless her? Was this at the end of his blessing for her? You know, he promised her, Eli said that she would have a son, but was that the end of the matter?
She had more children.
Yes, she did. In chapter 21, Susan Hendrick, would you read 21, please, of chapter 2?
And the Lord visited Hannah, and she conceived and gave birth to 3 sons and 2 daughters, and the boy Samuel grew before the Lord.
So she kept her promise, but God saw her faith, and he continued to bless her. And what a blessing that was to her, her faith. Sometimes when we do things that we feel like is required of us because of our faith or promises we make, I hear people make promises to God, and then they wind up not keeping them. And you think, well, how could you do that? How could you make such a statement to God? I knew a young man one time during the Vietnam War, and he prayed to come home. It was so horrible. And we wrote back and forth. He was a member of my family by marriage. And he said, I've promised God that no matter what it takes, if he'll just bring me home and let me stay home, I'll serve him the rest of my life. Well, God brought him home. He had 2 daughters, and one of them was stillborn. And he came home, and it wasn't a year till he didn't have anything to do with God anymore. And you think, well, that may not have been the answer you wanted, but God answered your prayer. And he came home to never go back to Vietnam. And so we better be careful, first of all, the promises we make to God, because he may answer that, but not in the way we want it, but we've still made the promise. And so, anyway, I think about that often when I think of people, when I hear people say, if God will just do this, I'll do that. Okay, be careful with your words. Okay, what lessons can we learn from Hannah?
Have patience.
That's right.
She trusted that God would hear her prayer, and you know, what if his answer had been no? I think that because her faith was deep, I think she would eventually have come to accept it. I mean, that's a supposition, I guess. But.
Well, we see through her faith, she was willing to give up her child. To me, that would be harder than never having any. You know, you promised this, and okay, God grants your wish. How can God really expect me to keep my promise? You know, he knows how bad I wanted this child. He really can't think I would give it up. And so you're right. I think probably she did have a great faith, and we can see that in her actions.
She didn't know she was going to have more children.
No, she didn't.
But she did get to see Samuel every year.
Yes, she did. Yes, she did. Anybody else?
Don't punish our husband.
Good. That's a good thing to remember. Wait. Don't go there. That's the next question. We're on what lessons can we learn from Hannah, not because of Hannah's faith, what blessings do we have today, which is Samuel's included in that.
Oh, there's something in
the
Eli? I missed it.
No, number 5. Question. Don't y'all have a question 5?
I thought that's
really... No, we're on 4. The lessons we can learn from Hannah.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. That's okay. We'll get there. We learn prayer is powerful.
Praise and thanksgiving.
Yes. We also learn that prayer is very powerful. When we pray to God, why should we think God's listening to me? I'm just a plain woman out here trying to serve my family, serve Him to the best I can. Hey, that's all Hannah was. She was just a regular woman. Her husband was not a priest. He wasn't of the priestly lineage. He's from Ephraim. She's just an everyday Jew. And yet God chose her story to put in the scriptures. And she prayed because she wanted the child. And then she prayed when she took the child back. And there's so many other things in this prayer that we could read, and how she exalted the Lord and all that. But we can see the power of prayer through her. And it's something, do we use prayer as we should, knowing how powerful it is? Another thing I put is God blesses those who keep their word. If she hadn't have kept her promise and given Samuel back to God, I don't know that He would have given her more children. She didn't. We don't learn that she had more children. In fact, in verse 20, then Eli would bless Hannah, his wife, and say, "May the Lord give you children from this woman in place of the one she has dedicated to the Lord," and they went to their own home. So it was after that that she had more children. So when we give our word for something and we don't keep it, especially to God, he hears that and He knows that. Another thing that I put down is we learn that God hears the prayers of those who believe and trust in Him. If we really believe and trust in God, we can have confidence that He's going to hear us when we pray to Him. Does that mean He's always going to answer in the affirmative or how we want it answered? No, it's not. Okay, now, Linda, because of Hannah's faith, what blessings do we continue to have today? Go ahead, Linda.
Okay. We have the written word that shows Samuel as a grown man, serve the Lord, and how even in disappointments he still served the Lord, even through a great grief with Saul. But you know, we saw him as a great judge in Israel, mm-hmm. and how God used him as he grew up to be a man. And we can learn from the example of Samuel.
Anybody else? You know, I don't know who wrote 1 and 2 Samuel. I don't know that we're told. I don't know that we have. I don't know. But the record of Samuel's life is a great blessing, as Linda has said. We see how, from the beginning of this imperfect woman, God brought about a great judge and a great prophet, not only for His people then, but in the record that He has left for us today. And so it's, we think sometimes and we see people that we feel are insignificant. And Hannah, at that time and in the scheme of things, she probably felt very insignificant and greatly blessed by this one child that she got and then the others that the Lord gave her. But all of this started out, the life of Samuel started out with the faith of Hannah. Okay, anything else to cover on Hannah real quick before we move on to Eli? I would like to get Eli today.
If Samuel's an Ephraimite, how did he
appear? That is something that has always been a conundrum to me. But remember, there was a time when there was really nobody to be priest, because all of the people old enough to serve as priests for Eli, his family all died. Hophni and Phinehas died the same day. The baby that the woman was having died. And so there was evidently some in between, but they were not old enough to serve as priests. It's the only thing that I have been able to determine in the scriptures. But he was allowed, you know, God allowed it is all I can tell you. There was a need, and Samuel stood up and took that place. But it seems like God put him in place for this purpose. Because even when we won't study all that, but going back and forth between when God was first talking to Samuel and told Samuel what he was going to do to Eli's household. You know, this is a young man that God is talking to, not Eli. I mean, he's told Eli, but then he tells Samuel, trying to prepare him for the work that he's going to have to do. That's the only answer I have. Do you have any other suggestions? Anybody else have any suggestions? If Eli was not of the, if Samuel was not of the tribe of Levi, he was an Ephraimite, how did he become a priest and offer the sacrifices and do all the things that he did in the interim? Okay, let's look at Eli. Eli and Samuel are pretty much intertwined, but Eli was also an imperfect servant in his own right. Can someone give me a brief synopsis? We won't read all these passages here. Why was God displeased with Eli's sons? What were they doing that made God so angry with them?
They weren't very good priests. They were taking the meat before they had a chance to boil it. They wanted to roast it or grill it or something. Mm-hmm. That's not what you're supposed to do. They just took it
mm-hmm.
when they weren't supposed to. The other thing I put was that they were sleeping with women at the tabernacle.
Yeah. They were. These are people who are supposedly offering sacrifices for your sins. And these are the things that they're doing. How can you respect them? The high priest was to be highly respected. He should have been if he was doing his work and doing it well. I don't see anything that they're doing right. And so...
One thing that was interesting that goes along with that is they had regular people talking to them and telling them what they should be telling other people.
That's right.
What they should be doing because they were priests.
But that just made them mad and they did what they wanted to anyway. So, and do we find that sometime today in churches? The elders are not doing what they should do or trying to implement something that should not be implemented, and members go and talk to them and sometimes they listen and sometimes they don't. So people have not changed. Sometimes once people get in the leadership role, they feel like they have the right to make the rules. But really, what was a priest? I don't know how to ask this without just saying it. Is anybody in authority ever in authority for their own gain?
No.
It's always for the good of the people they're governing. They're servants. And I think sometimes when someone gets a title, they forget that. These men sure did. They were acting as priests. They forgot that they were there to serve the people. They were there to serve themselves. They wanted what they wanted. I don't like boiled meat. I want it roasted or something different done to it. I don't like that. Doesn't matter what you like. When you have a job to do, you do it the way it's required. So why was God displeased with Eli?
He did not rebuke his sons. He didn't hold them accountable.
He did not hold them accountable. He did kind of rebuke them. If we look at 23 through...
Eventually he did, but it seemed like it was a time there where he should have and he didn't.
Yeah, but before God talks to him, it sounds like verse 20. Read, Susan Hendrick, did you read? I've lost. Okay, Sandra, read 23 through 25, I think. Yeah.
Chapter 2. So he said to them, why do you do such things? For I hear of your evil dealings from all the people. No, my son, for it is not a good report that I hear. You make the Lord's people transgress. If one man sins against another, God will judge him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who will intercede for him? Nevertheless, they did not heed the voice of their father, because the Lord decided to kill them.
Okay, in verse 22, it says when Eli was very old, he had heard of these things. And then when we get to verse 29, I think it is, let me be sure here, yeah. Let's start in verse 27. Elizabeth, would you read 27 through 29, please?
Then a man of God came to Eli and said to him, "Thus says the Lord, did I not indeed reveal myself to the house of your father when they were in Egypt in bondage to Pharaoh's house? Did I not choose them from all the tribes of Israel to be my priests, to go up to my altar, to burn incense, to carry an ephod before me? And did I not give the house of your father all the fire offerings of the sons of Israel? Why do you kick at my sacrifice and at my offering, which I have commanded in my dwelling, and honor your sons above me by making yourselves fat with the choicest of every offering of my people Israel?"
So evidently, he knew what was going on, and he had asked him, "Why are you doing this?" What did he have the right to do? As Eli was evidently the high priest, who, what did he have the right to do?
Remove
them. That's right. That wasn't only his right, but it was his responsibility. But he didn't do it. And so, and then God goes on to tell him that, verse 33, "Behold, the days are coming when I will break your strength and the strength of your father's house, so that there will not be an old man in your house." And then goes on to tell him that both of his sons would die in one day, and these kind of things. So God had a right to be angry with Eli, and you know, I don't understand why he didn't just kill them all. Sometimes that's what God did. He would just come in and kill everybody. But that was not what he did, and evidently he respected Eli enough. Verse 33, "Yet I will cut off every man of yours from my altar, so that your eyes will fail from weeping and your soul grieve, and all the increase of your house will die in the prime of life." And then he tells them in the next verse that Hophni and Phinehas would both die on the same day. And I guess those were his sons who were doing all the stuff. And yet God didn't strike them immediately like he did with Aaron's sons when they offered the wrong sacrifice. I don't understand God and his dealings with people, and we don't have to understand.
It's probably a hard saying for Samuel to hear, because Eli had been, you know, his mentor. He'd lived with him all those years. But when God tells Samuel, you know, there is no offering of sacrifice for forgiveness. There is no forgiveness for this. That would be pretty hard to hear. That's over in 3:14.
Mm-hmm.
And to say that God's not going to forgive. We thank God as such a loving God. You know, surely there's something that we can do, you know, for God's sake.
Well, these people weren't going to repent, and God knew that. I believe with all of my heart, if he would have seen one twinge of hope for them, that would have been different. But, you know, it got to the point where God told Jeremiah, don't pray for these people. They're too far gone. There's nothing that's going to change them. And nothing's going to change my mind about what I'm going to do about it. So don't ask me. And I think that's the case with these men here. They, you know, some people just get so hardened that there's just no hope for them. I've heard people say that there's anybody, if they just talk to the right person, can be converted. And I don't believe that. How many people did Jesus convert? When he died, how many people stood with him? None. They all left him. Jesus was the most powerful teacher there ever, taught everything just right, knew the right things to say, knew what to talk about, and yet he didn't convert everybody. They would leave him why were they following him, really? They wanted to eat. And so, but these men were too far gone. But even after he knows what's going to happen to them, it's interesting to me, this shows Eli still is a man of faith. Let's read chapter 3 and verse 18. Bobby, would you read chapter 3 of 2 Samuel, verse 18? 1 Samuel. I'm sorry, what did I say?
Samuel.
I'm sorry. Samuel. Just 1 Samuel.
3 and 18, did you say?
Yes, please.
And Samuel told him,
every whit and hid nothing from him. And he said, it is the Lord, let him do what seemeth to him good.
This is after Samuel has been, God has talked to Samuel and has the, he has the vision, and he tells Samuel, I've told Eli I'm going to judge his house. Says he knew what his sons were doing, and he did not rebuke them. He said something to them, but that doesn't, this rebuke here entails more than just slapping their hands. He should have done something about it. But then Samuel just says, it's the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him. How many of us, if we were told that our children were going to be killed because of their sinfulness, and there's nothing you can do about it, do you think we would at least try one more time to pray for them? God, please spare them a little longer. Maybe something will change them. I have some grandchildren that's all I know to pray for them. God, grant them time to come back to where they know they need to be. But God says, there's nothing going to change this. And yet Eli seems content with it. I'm sure he's not happy about it, but he doesn't say anything bad about God or rebuke God, you know, or say, this is my fault, it's not theirs. How many times do you hear parents jump in and want to take the blame when their kids really done something horrible? Well, there must be something I didn't do right. Must be my fault somehow. No, it's not your fault. They're grown people. They made their own choices. Did you make a mistake as a parent? Yes. I don't know a parent that didn't. But it's still not our fault when they're doing what they're doing.
You know, because Eli was in the position that he was in, because the law demanded not only that they be removed, but in my judgment that they be killed, you know, because they did not listen to their father.
Well, yeah, because Eli had a position
that
he should have stopped this.
Yeah.
It wasn't, you know, he couldn't just walk away and say, well, they're grown men. Because he had the right and the responsibility to see that they stopped this. He was high priest. And the high priest could have had him put to death. That's what should have happened to them. Because there's, in the old law, there are certain things, you die for this. And so he was held responsible. He did have some guilt in this part for what he did not do. Well, I really thought we would get through Elijah today.
Okay.
All right. Is there any other questions or comments about the class?